Thank you. Yeah, so I'm going to be talking about minimum length scenarios inspired by the Planck scale, or at the Planck scale. So one way of tackling Planck scale physics is to postulate some theory of quantum gravity and then trying to derive low energy effects that this might have. But what we're trying to do is a complementary approach where we take ordinary quantum field theory that's well established at low energies and try to see how we can modify it in such a way, in sort of a minimalistic way, in order to start to incorporate some Planck scale effects in just ordinary quantum field theory. And the idea would be somehow match these at some point. But today I'm just going to be talking about how we can modify quantum field theory in a way to start introducing minimum length scenario effects at the Planck scale. And in particular, I'm going to be interested in trying to do this in a way that maintains continuous symmetries. So first I'm going to be talking about Euclidean symmetries, how we can maintain these, and then introduce boosts and talk about Lorentzian symmetries. So this is based on, mostly based on these two papers. So one where we consider the Euclidean version of these minimum length symmetric scenarios, and another one I wrote this year on Lorentzian generalization. Okay, so what's the motivation for this? Well, it's a conceptual problem that at the Planck scale with what happens when we combine the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics with the general relativity field equations. And so there's lots of versions of this argument, but this very simple rough scenario is something like if I want to take a particle and try to localize it as much as possible, if we include gravitational effects in this, then you would think that you can't localize this beyond the Schwarzschild radius of the particle we're talking about. And now, so that gives us this first inequality. But now if we include the uncertainty principle in this, what it gives us is a minimum uncertainty in our position given somewhere on the Planck scale. So this indicates, I mean, this is one way to see that something dramatic is going to happen at the Planck scale. And in particular, that it indicates that there might be some effective minimum length at this scale that we can talk about. So some people will look at this and say, okay, well, so maybe there's some minimum length. Maybe space-time somehow, or a naive way of looking at it is maybe space-time becomes a lattice with the Planck spacing at this scale. But what I want to look at is, are we forced into such a scenario? Do we really, if we want to implement a minimum length, do we really have to talk about putting fields on a lattice? And do we have to give up space-time symmetries, which are important, for example, to the structure of the standard model? Now, instead of talking about minimum lengths per se, I'm going to be really focusing on the uncertainty in position. Because uncertainty is something we have in quantum mechanics, we have a good handle on this. So instead of just talking about replacing the structure of space-time with something different, I want to focus on the fact that in these sort of scenarios, you're talking about a minimum uncertainty in position. And so one way of modeling these minimum position uncertainties is with generalized uncertainty principles. And so the idea behind this is just try to directly modify the uncertainty principle in a way where we get minimum position uncertainty at the Planck scale. So at low uncertainties and momentum, we don't have a problem. We can just use the ordinary quantum mechanical uncertainty. But the problem comes in where we're going to see Planck scale effects is where when the momentum uncertainty starts to get large, because this is going to feed into the field equations to give us large uncertainty in geometry. And so the idea is just to take the ordinary uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics, so this dotted line here, and kick it up a bit so that at large momentum uncertainty, the position uncertainty starts to increase again. And so this is sort of a very crude way of modeling an uncertainty in geometry. So the idea is to take an uncertainty principle, the ordinary one, and replace it with something that looks like this, where we modify the right-hand side with something like a Planck scale squared and an uncertainty momentum squared. And this is qualitatively does something like this. And it, in particular, it gives us a minimum uncertainty in the position. And so this is just how you can modify the uncertainty principle. But A more practical way of doing it is by modifying the commutation relations, which then imply such an uncertainty principle. But if we modify commutation relations like this, we can talk about how quantum mechanics gets modified by introducing these Planck scale effects, or how we can start to introduce these Planck scale effects within quantum mechanics. And so one way of doing it is like this, where we can get a modified inner product for our state spaces. And so a model like this was introduced in this paper here some time ago. But this is just quantum mechanics. Really, we want to introduce this into quantum field theory. And we want to figure out what kind of effects this will have on quantum field theory. And so now we get into band limitation and sampling theory, because it turns out there's a simple way of understanding these generalized uncertainty principles in terms of some theorems in information theory and communications engineering. GUP will introduce a UV cutoff in the form of a band limit, and then we can use some powerful theorems from communications engineering to talk about discrete and continuous, equivalent discrete and continuous representations of fields. So what I want to talk about first is how do we take the GUP and insert it into quantum field theory? So the simple way of understanding, of building a classical space, which we then quantize in quantum field theory, is to look at the representation spaces of the Poincaré group. And so we just take our rotation boost and our translation generators. And from this, we can build representations of classical field configurations in momentum space. And so this is a simple thing to do. But now, the usual story is we take these momentum space representations of fields, and then, well, in momentum space, how do we get to position space? Well, we just take a Fourier transform. But the key thing I want to point out is that these Fourier factors, underlying these is a Heisenberg algebra, because these Fourier factors really come from an overlap between a position eigenvector and a momentum eigenvector. And so underlying all this, really implicitly, the Heisenberg algebra sets the stage for the space, and the momentum space that these fields live on. And so what this does is gives us an opportunity for how we can introduce the generalized uncertainty principle into quantum field theory, because now we can look at this Heisenberg algebra and take a modification of this Heisenberg algebra, and it'll set a new stage for our quantum fields. And one thing what we'll find is that the spectra of these position operators with the GUP will change. So in this case, our x's are labeled by the joint spectra of our position operators. And so, yeah?
P is at three-dimensional, four-dimensional here. It's just spectra space-time. I'm confused about the notation. P is three or four-dimensional?
So here it's four dimensions. But
the first line also?
In first slide?
The first equation?
Here?
Yeah.
So yeah, here it's four-dimensional. So for this story, it's four-dimensional. But when I put in the GUP, I'm just going to be talking about the spatial piece. But I'm going to be using the same sort of structure when I do the Lorentzian version of it as well. Right, so I was saying that the spectra of the position operators gives us our coordinates on which the fields lie. And when we do the generalized uncertainty principle and put these in, we'll find that these the spectra of these position operators will become discrete, and this will give us this will give us the discrete representations that we'll find in sampling theory. So now I'm just going to be talking about a one-dimensional case, but the same kind of story holds in higher dimensions for higher Euclidean dimensions, and eventually later I'll talk about Lorentzian case, but I just want to talk about the simple case for now. We have this one-dimensional modified Heisenberg algebra, and it turns out there's a simple way to think about what this is doing by doing a coordinate change on momentum space. So if we change the coordinates using something like this, specific coordinate change here, we end up with a K operator that has the canonical commutation relations with the ordinary, with the position operator here. So we have the ordinary Heisenberg algebra. But the range of this K is restricted. And so what we end up with is a band limitation of fields on the space, which just means that we have an ultraviolet cutoff on these fields. And so this is just a much simpler way of dealing with fields that live on the structure implied by this Heisenberg algebra. And so now that we have a compact momentum space, we can look at the spectra of the position operators on this space, and naturally it becomes discrete. But it turns out that we get a whole family of spectra because we can apply different boundary conditions in momentum space. And so this gives us a whole family of different discrete eigenvalues for a family of discrete family of different position operators. And it turns out because we have this family, although we have discrete representations, discrete position eigenvalues, because we have a whole family, this will allow us to maintain an underlying continuous manifold as well as Euclidean symmetries. So before I get into the full story of sampling theory, I'm just going to give a very simple finite dimensional example. So suppose instead of considering fields on a one-dimensional line, let's consider just fields on a circle. Now our analog of band limitation here will be just cutting off, putting ultraviolet cutoff on the Fourier modes, the number of Fourier modes we have. So suppose we did a cutoff so we have 5 Fourier modes. Then all we need is these 5 Fourier coefficients to specify a field in the space. But now, because we can specify a field with just 5 pieces of information, it turns out it suffices to just specify the field amplitude at 5 different points in space. And so the way you can see this, a simple way of seeing it is just the field amplitude at different points, different sample points along the circle. You can write in terms of the Fourier coefficients, and then generally the relation between the Fourier coefficients and the amplitudes are given by some matrix. Now, generically, this matrix will be invertible unless you put the sample points just right on top of each other. And so you can write the Fourier coefficients in terms of these amplitude at these sample points, and then plug this back in here to get the field on the whole circle just from the values on a certain finite number of sample points. And then it's simple to write down what this reconstruction kernel should be. But the point being that we can represent our fields on a lattice of points, yet still have the underlying continuous space and a continuous representation of fields on this space. And now one point I want to make is that we don't have to choose these sample points equidistantly. We can just sort of put them non-equidistantly all over the place, as long as two of them aren't on top of each other. Now, so this is a very simple situation. But the full sampling theory on the line is just the same analogous situation extended to the whole real line. And now here we have an infinite dimensional function space, but the basic idea still holds, is that we can, with this ultraviolet cutoff, we can sample the field at a discrete set of points in space, and this will completely specify a field in the whole space. And it's because we're allowed to pick these sample points sort of anywhere we want on the line is why we can still have a continuous representation and why we still maintain continuous Euclidean symmetries for these fields. And so the simplest situation is when we have these equidistantly spaced points, and then we recover this reconstruction kernel, which is the statement of the Shannon-Whitaker sampling theorem. And this, the spacing of these points is at the Nyquist spacing. So this is a critical spacing. If you sample more sparsely than this, then you can't reconstruct fields. But as long as you sample more densely than this critical density, we can reconstruct the fields exactly just by these set of sample points, discrete set of sample points. And we can also do it non-equidistantly, so pick the points at non-equidistant spacings. As long as the average density of the points hits this critical Nyquist density, we can still cook up a reconstruction kernel, which will depend on exactly where we put these points. But again, to reiterate, the point is that we can have discrete representations of the field, so it looks like it's on a lattice after picking a certain set of sample points, but we still have continuous symmetries for these fields. Okay, then I want to talk about quantization of these fields, and but really focusing on what the independent degrees of freedom of these fields are, given the fact that you can move all the sample points around. It turns out that the Nyquist space position eigenvectors that correspond to these position operators that I was using in the GUP, the eigenvectors of these form an orthonormal basis for the set of classical field configurations. And the one parameter family bases of these one parameter set of bases for the classical configuration space. And each of these completely covers, not each of them, but all together, they completely cover the real line. But if we take these, we can take the one set of these orthonormal basis vectors, and the independent degrees of freedom will be at the fields at these points, and we can construct a Hilbert space by just tensoring together the field degrees of freedom at each of these basis points. And then if we choose a different lattice, so a shifted lattice, we can construct a similar construction to make a Hilbert space. And it turns out no matter which lattice we choose, we get the same Hilbert space every time. But then the question is, okay, so if we chose non-equidistant points, do we still get the same Hilbert space? It turns out yes, but it won't factorize into a tensor product over these sample points because these aren't orthogonal in the classical space. So now what we wanted to look at, so now we have our quantum field theories on these spaces. We wanted to look at where the degrees of freedom are. How can we understand where the degrees of freedom are given the fact that we can move these sample points around? Because if we just have a lattice, it's natural to consider the degrees of freedom as existing at each lattice point. But now if we move them around in a particular, in a non-equidistant way, can we understand where the degrees of freedom went? So naturally, if you had sort of sample point there before and you moved it over here, where is this degree of freedom now lying? Is it how is it included in all the other sample points in this representation? So the way we looked at tackling that was in considering the entanglement entropy for these subsystems of lattice points. So what we looked at was looked at the Nyquist space lattice points. So if you take a finite number of these lattice points at this critical density, then how does it scale? How does entropy scale with the number of lattice points you have? And we found that it scales as 1/3 log in 1+1 dimension, 1/3 log of the number of sample points. Now this is consistent with our conformal field theory results in the continuum that it should be log of the length of the interval in Planck units, because the length of this interval is n times the distance between these, which is the Planck length, and then in Planck units that's just n. So that's consistent. One thing we wanted to know was, okay, so now how does this depend on the spacing between these points? If we start increasing or decreasing the spacing between these points beyond the Nyquist density, how does the entropy behave? And so we have, this is the plot we have. So this is the entanglement entropy of, I think, 5 lattice points. And this is the distance between the adjacent lattice points. And so when these points are very far away, we have entropy up here. And then as we decrease the density towards the Nyquist density, this critical density, we're here. And now, interestingly, what we found was that as we start decreasing the distance between these sample points, the entropy doesn't actually change. So why this is surprising is because if this entropy corresponds to the information content of these points, then as we go from the Nyquist density to a smaller density, we don't decrease the amount of information contained in these points because the entropy just depends on the number of them. This appears paradoxical because it means that we can shove a bunch of points into a very small region and get the same entropy out. So it seems like we can just put as much information in as small a region of space as we want. And this is sort of inconsistent with the idea that this should model a finite information density or finite density degrees of freedom. What we found is that actually this isn't consistent. This is a consistent story, but the idea that these sample points really just characterize, really don't just characterize a small Planck scale distance around where these points are located. And so the way we tackled this question was trying to use the entropy to infer the locality of these degrees of freedom. So what we did was take a finite set of sample points. So this is like our endpoints we want to know about, our subsystem. And we have another probe point, and we want to consider the mutual information between these finite set of sample points and this one probe point as a function of both the distance between these points and the location of this probe point. So what we expect, say, if this were just one point, we'd expect that two points, as they get closer and closer together, the mutual information between them starts increasing. So the idea is, as this gets closer, as this is far away, the mutual information is low. And as we get closer, it should start to go up and peak around this point, and then decrease again as we go away from this point. And so what we expect is some sort of peak that's a net a Planck scale distance around this point.
We have a question.
Yeah.
Following the general logic, what is S exactly? What is the entropy of what?
Oh, sorry. It's the entanglement entropy. So if we have a field on the full lattice, and then we look at some finite subset of lattice points, and we trace out the state, the field on all the other lattice points, and we look at the entropy of the reduced state on the finite number subset of these lattice points. And then we calculate.
You have a given state?
Oh, sorry, in the ground state, global ground state of the field.
A ground state of, you have a free field?
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah, it's a free Klein-Gordon field living on these. Yeah. And then it's in the ground state, and we're, and then.
Is a free Klein-Gordon field in the continuum or in the?
So, yeah, it's in the continuum, but it also admits these discrete representations. And so I can represent the free Klein-Gordon field on one of these lattices.
You haven't given this part of the story somehow. Am I supposed to have understood all that?
No, sorry, I forgot to mention the field I was looking at. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. But the story about the discrete versus continuum representation.
There's not happening in this finite dimensional Hilbert space. You need a
No, so
a finite dimension of the space, it's the Fock space.
Yeah, so right. So I have these field configurations. So this is a classical, like kinematics, a classical set of field configurations, which have this equivalent discrete representations on a lattice and on the full real line. So it's still an infinite dimensional. The classical Hilbert space is still infinite dimensional. And then you can write down a Klein-Gordon equation or like a Klein-Gordon action for these fields and just restrict it to with the band limit, so restrict the momentum space with our band limit. And then we end up with the ones that obey this reconstruction equation. And so you can so we have the ordinary Klein-Gordon equation with our continuous field configurations, but then this can also be represented on this lattice. So we also get a discrete representation of the derivative operator.
In momentum space,
yeah.
The wave function is a Gaussian.
Yes.
And so you are cutting off the tails of the Gaussian. Is that what is happening? Like the restriction to a finite bandwidth is just limiting, like looking at the Gaussian between, instead of on the full real line, just on a segment. Is more complicated.
Cutting off the momentum space.
What is vacuum? Because vacuum is spread in momentum space.
Oh, it's the same as the usual Klein-Gordon vacuum.
But that goes all over.
Oh, yes. It's infinite space.
In momentum space.
No, but in momentum space, it's restricted. But it's just Klein-Gordon theory, where you're not considering all modes, but just modes down to the landscape, and then the other ones are assumed to be absolute. Later we took a relativistic version, so we found that but in the relativistic version, there's no more and then the point was that if you assume that, if you have this band limitation, then your quantum theory can be written down on any lattice that has a Planckian spacing or an average of Planckian spacing, and you're not making an approximation.
No, but this beginning,
so,
most at the beginning. I mean, what is the Hilbert space and what is this S? Is there a formula for this S? What is it?
Okay, so how you can build the Fox?
Not something simple, but.
Yeah, so how you can build the Fox space of the theory is just the ordinary Hamiltonian, the Klein-Gordon equation, and then you restrict the K space, and then but then it, for all the Ks you still allow, you can still construct the same Fox space with your creation annihilation operator. It's just when you then Fourier transform to get this to position space, then these admit discrete representations in position space. And so we can build a Fox space sort of. So at each lattice point, we can build a Fox space. We can build a creation annihilation operator with the
this infinite dimensional.
Yes.
Space.
Yes. And there's still an infinite. So at each point, you can take the field operators and construct a creation annihilation operators with these, and construct a Fox space at each point, and then tensor together all the points.
How do you build a Fox space at a point?
I mean, you can construct a annihilation operator B. It's something like some linear combination of phi and pi at one point. So these obey some commutation relations. So phi at one point and pi at another point on one of these lattices is still I delta nm, like this. And then you can construct a Fox space, and so you get a bunch of Fox spaces at each point, and then you can tensor them all together to get a full Hilbert space for the field theory. And then you can rearrange the degrees of freedom to the ordinary Fox spaces you construct in momentum space. But now the point being that we have a bunch of these lattices, and so if you take another lattice and then do the same construction, you end up with the same Hilbert space. Yep.
Sorry, one more point of clarification. So in quantum field theory, as I know it, K would actually live on the mass shell, right? So you'd have like the Fourier transform of Klein-Gordon equation is K squared plus M squared.
Yeah.
So K is on this mass hyperboloid usually. This doesn't seem. Or is it the case? So you're cutting this.
Yeah, so I'm just taking this hyperboloid and then cutting it at a certain momentum.
Okay.
Yeah, and then it only can go so far.
Of course, you don't have, or do you still have a solution to Klein-Gordon equation in some sense?
Yeah, it's just that there. So in momentum space, sorry, the solutions are still, you know, wk squared, 5k. Like this, so you still have, like in momentum space, you still have this, but then you can Fourier transform back, and then when you do that, you can either do it in the continuum, in which case it still looks like the ordinary one with the derivatives, or you can also represent it on these lattices, so you get discrete representations of these derivatives as well.
I'm assuming that the discrete Klein-Gordon doesn't get a modification from the lattice structure.
Discrete Klein-Gordon, but
you don't have any correction to the Laplace, for instance, the box.
The derivative operator we're cutting off its spectrum, right? So, I mean, you can write. So I don't know what you mean by the.
In the discrete, if you go to a lattice.
Yeah.
And you write the Klein-Gordon on the lattice.
Yeah. Then this.
There are no correction to the Klein-Gordon.
Oh, yeah.
It's an assumption, right?
Yes. Yeah, I'm assuming it's the same. It's just that the derivative is going to have some lattice representation, which is not just like a finite difference thing. It's something more complicated.
Yeah, exactly. So the derivative operators included in the Laplace becomes a finite difference operator. And there's no choice in that. It is determined from. Basically, because you can take function, and you can take your field as living on a lattice, and then you reconstruct it as living on the continuum, which you can do because of the sampling theory. Then once you have it as a living on a continuum, you can do a derivative on it, like the Laplacian. But then you can represent it on a lattice again. So overall, it was a map from lattice to lattice. And therefore, the action of the derivative, like the Laplacian, is just a map from lattice to lattice. And it turns out to be a finite difference operation, but it's not just nearest neighbors. It's more complicated than that.
How you would derive it is you just take a derivative operator, act on here, and then it acts on the sync function.
So you can reverse back engineer a discrete derivative such that it gives you the
a map from lattice to lattice.
It's very important to do it this way because then you're ensuring that you can work with any lattice you want and you're not breaking the translation. You can't just discretize the derivative.
Are you in a compact space here?
No, this is just on R.
So the space of the solutions of the Klein-Gödel equation that solve the Klein-Gödel that have a momentum bounded, it's finite dimension or infinite dimension?
The space of solutions is an infinite dimension.
Infinite dimension.
But you're restricting the space of solutions greatly, right?
How true.
How do we go down to a finite dimension? So that's what I'm less.
No, he's not going down to finite dimension.
So I gave an example on the circle, which was a finite dimensional space, but that was sort of an analog. But so now here we're back on the, so this is the full real line, and we have like discrete representations, so we have a discrete set of sample points, but it's still infinite in both directions.
So you still need infinitely many sample points.
Yes,
okay,
yeah.
But it's a discrete set.
Okay. But it's discrete. That's a...
That's helps already. Like,
okay.
I was confused by that. And the entropy, that's helpful. And the entropy is, do you have a formula for the entropy? What is it exactly?
For the entanglement entropy.
Between what and what?
So we have a field living on these lattices that go infinite in both directions. And then you can take a finite number of these points in some sub-interval, for example, and then trace out, and then once you have the Fock space and the quantum field theory construction, you can find a ground state for the Klein-Gödel equation on the fields on this lattice, and then trace out everything outside, because we have a tensor decomposition over these lattice points, so we can trace out the Hilbert spaces on all the other lattice points, and we get a reduced state on these finite number of sample points, and then the S is just the von Neumann entropy of that state.
Okay.
Yes.
So on that note, you said that...
Now I'm more important. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your question. So
when you no longer have the uniform sampling, you don't have that tensor product.
Yeah.
So then how do you calculate this entropy? Jumping ahead, sorry.
No, that's fine. So in this case, you'd have such a thing, right? Because even though they're equidistantly spaced, they're sort of beyond the critical density where you have the independent degrees of freedom. So technically what we do is, so if you take these set of degrees of freedom, so actually what we did was, because we have a Gaussian state, we can have a phase space representation for our wave functions. And so what we did was look at the subspace of that phase space that these finite number of degrees of freedom span, and then that we define that subspace, whatever that spans, to be our subsystem. And then it involves a symplectic diagonalization of the covariance matrix on that subspace. And then so it's really this subspace and the rest, which is going to be some non-local combination of the other degrees of freedom. And they're not actually going to correspond to sample points, like another set of sample points. It's just we have this subsystem defined by these and the rest. And so we don't have, you're right, we don't have a nice tensor product decomposition, but we can still define a tensor decomposition in terms of this subsystem and whatever the rest is. And that's what the entanglement entropy we're calculating for that subsystem is. Yes. So in this case, we were looking at the entanglement entropy for a bunch of points that we put close together. And now in this case, we were looking at, suppose we had some set of subsystem defined by these sample points and one other sample point here, and we want the mutual information between these ones. Now we still have a bunch of lattice points elsewhere in the space, or tracing all those ones out. But the mutual information we can just calculate by looking at these points together. And the question we wanted to tackle was, okay, so how can we use this to infer where these, where the degrees of freedom of these points are sitting, even when we take them and push them all close together? So this is a complicated plot, but basically this is the plot of the mutual information in sort of coming out of the board. And this vertical axis is the distance between 5 sample points. And this is the location of this other probe point. And so up here, for example, if we have the subsystem where the points are spaced far apart, then we're in this situation here, this slice of this plot here. It looks like this. And as we move this probe point along these other points, what we see is that it peaks in some sort of Planck scale region around one of these points. And so in this sense, you can say that, okay, this degree of freedom sort of lives in this region because the mutual information is peaking here. But actually, I'm going to skip this part. I'm going to look at just this part here. So this is this critical Nyquist density. And remember, this was consistent with the conformal field theory result, that as we go over a set of equidistantly spaced points, then the entropy just depends on the length of this interval. And so what we see here is that as these points are at the Nyquist spacing, we get something that looks like an interval over these 5 sample points. And now the point I want to make is that, remember, we found that as we put these points closer together, the entropy didn't decrease. But what we find here is that the interval that they describe also does not decrease. So it means that if you take these points and put them all close together, actually the location of that subsystem is actually the original interval of the original 5 sample points at the Nyquist density. So what this means is that we're actually not shoving more information to a smaller region of space, but actually even if we take these sample points below the spacing, these degrees of freedom are in a sense incompressible because we find that they describe the same region of space as they did before. So that was the story for the Euclidean case. So we had started with the GUPs, and I looked at in one dimensions, but this you can extend to higher dimensions, Euclidean case. And then from that, we end up with band limitation and sampling theory. And sampling theory is this equivalence between representing fields on a lattice and representing fields on the continuum. And then we looked at the entropy, entanglement entropy between subsystems to get an idea of how these where these degrees of freedom are located. So now the question is, what about boosts? What happens when you start including boosts into the scenario? What do we have to give up? Because the idea of, if we put a sharp cutoff in momentum, this isn't a covariant notion. And if we have some sort of minimum length, this isn't a covariant notion. So the way I started with this was looking at Lorentzian analogs of the generalized uncertainty principle. So what I took was the Heisenberg algebra, and now these indices are over space and time. So we have our 4 momenta, and momenta I have Greek indices, and the positions I have Latin indices, uppercase Latin indices, and all of these are going over space and time dimensions, directions. And so in an analogy to the GUP, I'm going to modify the XP commutator in some, for now, generic way by some sort of functions that depend on the momenta. So this is analogous to the one-dimensional GUP. And I'm going to keep the geometry commutative just for simplicity and the momentum commutative also just for simplicity to see what we get in analogy in sort of in a minimum modification of the uncertainty principle I was considering before in the Lorentzian case. And so as before, it's easy to build momentum space representations of this algebra. So the momentum is just some sort of multiplication operator, or it's just the multiplication operator here. And the position operators are these vector fields on momentum space. And you can build the Lorentz generators like this. So now, does this give us band limitation or some analog of band limitation and some analog of sampling theory when we have GUPs that look like this? So when you play around with these representations, it turns out that what it looks like is just that you're giving momentum space a geometry. So it turns out the position operators that I defined above are just, you can interpret these as co-tetrads for some metric in momentum space. But now we have constraints because we assume the coordinates are commuting. So what this means, the fact that all the coordinates are commuting means that we can find a local diffeomorphism so that in that coordinate system, the position operators are just coordinate derivatives. And so this is analogous to this coordinate transformation I did in the GUP case, which eventually gave us band limitation. And so the basic story here is that you can do the same thing in this case, assuming the coordinates are commuted. So you can trivialize the algebra, but also you can get a notion of covariant band limitation. And what this looks like in K-space is we get sort of a picture that looks like this. So an analog of band limitation when we have our spatial wavelengths restricted, so the wavelengths can't go below the Planck length. Here we have a different condition, which is that the K0 squared minus K vector squared has to be smaller than some cutoff scale. So the cutoff is actually on different mass shells. So they're given by these hyperbolas. So this is the region of momentum space that we're throwing out. And we're restricting our fields to living in momentum space between these four hyperbola. So
I feel already satisfied.
Okay.
Isn't the massive, this is just, if I don't understand, isn't
yeah.
a massive scalar field of mass m already satisfying this?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, so I'll get to that in a second. You're right. So for example, this hyperbola here would correspond to, if we had some particular field with a particular mass, it would lie, the field configuration would lie on the shell, the on-shell field configuration. Yeah.
We're saying that, remember that he's considering second quantization and the path integral when you path integrate over all field configurations normally. But he's restricting now the space of fields that is still being integrated over. So that no longer all field configurations are sampled over. Those that are too far away from the mass shell, those that would correspond to virtual masses beyond the Planck mass, they would no longer occur in the path integral.
I see.
So it,
yeah, so
it's an off-shell thing.
Okay. Yeah.
Just a brief remark. I mean, this is exactly what you do in constructive quantum field theory when you kind of set a cutoff scale and then integrate out all the fields which are beyond that cutoff scale, then you kind of have behavior with the scaling.
But remember, he's not integrating them out. He's assuming they're not there.
But I mean, effectively, you're kind of looking only at solutions which have these modes kind of thrown out. So I'm just wondering if effectively doesn't actually boil down to integrating out fields which are like beyond a certain cutoff.
One of
just feels like it should.
It's related.
Well, yeah. So in a free theory, it seems it would be that because the momenta are decoupled. But in an interacting theory, this might change.
Yeah, it's good to understand free theory as well.
Sure.
So I think in what you said before, it kind of corresponds to how you do it in constructive quantum field theory. But maybe when
mm-hmm.
you go to the interactions, then you do something else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just the intuition, like in an interacting theory, we'd have the, you know, momenta coupling to each other. I mean, in a free theory, these are going to be completely decoupled from each other. And so integrating them, it would be equivalent to integrating them out in a free theory. But I don't know, an interacting theory might be different. Yeah, that's the only point I was trying to make. Right, so I guess I'll get back to this point, is that when you quantize fields living on this momentum space, it corresponds to cutting out off-shell fluctuations. So we can't have fluctuations which are arbitrarily far off-shell. But I want to talk about right now the corresponding sampling theory that you get, or what's left of sampling theory when you have fields living on a momentum space that's restricted like this. So because we have an infinite volume of momentum space, it turns out that you end up with an infinite density of degrees of freedom in space-time. And so this is a consequence of a Landau-Berling theorem, which is an old theorem in information theory, or communications engineering, that if you have that the density, this critical Nyquist density at which you have to sample, is proportional to the volume of momentum space. But now, because we're restricting between these hyperbola, we have an infinite volume of momentum space, and so you have an infinite density of degrees of freedom. But is there a way to understand the sampling theory in or what this does in terms of something that looks like a sampling theory? And so the trick is what we do is look at how this works mode-wise. So if you look at a particular wave vector k, a particular wavelength, then it has a finite temporal bandwidth. So it's band limited in time, which means that we can construct for each spatial mode a sampling theory in time. And so the reconstruction would be some kernel. So you can write this down explicitly, but it's long formula, it's complicated. But you can cook up you have a reconstruction kernel in time for these spatial modes. And then to reconstruct the field in space, you still have to integrate over all the spatial modes. But the point is that for each spatial mode, we have a discrete set of points in time at which we have to sample these. But now the question is, okay, is there some set of temporal sampling lattices that suffices for all modes? So it turns out that if you look at this, that as we go from very small wave numbers to wave numbers, and this is given by this Planck scale here, as we get higher, the bandwidth in time actually starts increasing until you get to about a maximum here at the Planck scale. And then as you keep increasing the wave number, so the wavelength, if you decrease these beyond the Planck scale, then we get a dramatic drop in the bandwidth because we're not allowed to have any modes out. The bandwidth is just given by this, so we're not allowed to have any energies out here. So we get a dramatic drop in the bandwidth. So as the wavelengths get smaller and smaller on the Planck scale, then they effectively freeze out in the sense that the volume of momentum space corresponding to one of these modes above the Planck scale is very small, which means that we only have to sample it very sparsely in time in order to reconstruct it. And so the maximum bandwidth will suffice to reconstruct. So sampling at the density given by this maximum bandwidth suffices to reconstruct all the modes for the whole space-time just by sampling on this, on the temporal sampling lattice given by that density. And so, but it turns out that this picture, that picture only works in one dimension and two dimensions. So two dimensions is the critical dimension, and in three dimensions, actually the volume here of this temporal bandwidth actually starts increasing as you get to higher and higher wave numbers. And so you can't actually do this overall reconstruction for all the modes together on some temporal sampling lattice. So I think that's all I want to say here is that this is sort of the analog or what remains of the sampling theory when you try to do this cutoff covariantly and do a covariant band limit, is that you still have a continuum of degrees of freedom in space, but you can sample these in time at some temporal lattice. But then the question is, how could this possibly be covariant? Because I say, okay, so as your wavelength gets smaller than the Planck length, it's got a vanishingly small temporal bandwidth, which means it sort of freezes out in the sense that you have to sample it sparsely in time. But the reason that statement is covariant is because as we boost and so suppose we were to boost so that one of these very small wavelengths above the Planck scale goes down to become a larger wavelength, then the temporal bandwidth also increases. And so the reason that you can talk about these temporal sampling lattices for these modes and have that be a covariant statement is that the bandwidth also changes in time, is subject to time dilation. So it's this conspiring of the length contraction and the time dilation, which allows you to do this in a covariant way. And so I'm just going to talk briefly about effects that this has. So we've already discussed that this doesn't change the mass shell, so any on-shell quantities won't change. So for example, the two-point, the Whiteman function, the commutator, and or the anti-commutators, these expectation values of quantum fields won't change on-shell. And so because there are, for example, for a free Klein-Gordon field, if you're looking at that, on Minkowski space, then entanglement entropy between spatial degrees of freedom will still diverge because you can calculate entanglement entropy for Gaussian state with these on-shell quantities. So that's still going to diverge. And for example, the Unruh effect doesn't change because we're just modifying off-shell fluctuations. And one way to think about the Unruh effect in a sort of detector model is that it corresponds to a Feynman diagram that looks like this. It's like this. So if this is the a line for the Klein-Gordon field or electromagnetic field, and this is for a qubit, then it's just a single vertex where you have a creation of a particle or creation of a particle in the field along with an excitation of a detector because you're on this accelerated trajectory. But because there's no internal, so this is a sort of quantum mechanical system, this is the field. But because there's no internal field lines, there's no way that something off-shell could affect the thermal response of a detector accelerating in flat space-time. But what these authors showed is that it will have an effect on something on things that depend on off-shell quantities. So, for example, the Feynman propagator or the retarded and advanced propagators. So they looked at this in the context of cosmology. So it turns out you can also talk about this covariant band limit in the context of a fixed curved background. And so the idea is to cut off mass shells in the same sense that we did in flat space-time. So you can look at some covariant differential operator and cut off its spectrum. An analogy to the cutting off the spectrum of a differential operator on flat space-time. And you can work out some consequences of this. So what they looked at, for example, was the fluctuation spectrum of a field in inflationary cosmology. And they found that the Feynman propagator actually gets some modification. So this is a relative difference of the fluctuation spectrum given by the Feynman propagator. And they found that you get these sort of modifications and the fluctuations of scalar fields. What I'm working on now is how this affects how you can see effects like this on Schwarzschild spacetime. But I'm not going to talk about that today. So just to conclude, so I looked at started with GUPs and looked at how this gives rise to band limitation and gives. Which implies sampling theory in terms of lattice representations, which are equivalent to continuous representations. And this is how we maintain Euclidean symmetries for these fields. And I also showed how this gives a regulation of the information density of these fields. In the Lorentzian case, you can do an analogous story where you have a generalized uncertainty principle giving rise to a kind of covariant band limitation. And this gives a corresponding sampling theory for these fields, which is more subtle than the one we get in the Euclidean case. And one way you can think about this is as restricting the off-shell fluctuations as you would have in the when you integrate over fields in the path integral. And so now in future work, or what I'm working on now, is the effects that this has on interacting theories and further effects this has on curved space-time in analogy to the cosmology picture I had in the previous slide. So that's it. Thanks for your attention.
Does anyone have time for questions?
I wonder if you guys have looked at what happened in loop quantum duality where there is a finite length and at the same time a Lorentz invariant. And whether, because if what you're doing, somehow you should get to the same story. You're building up from the But what I've been able to see is that when you when you measure a distance in one frame, I mean the Euclidean part is pretty clear. It's a,
okay.
It's a Lorentzian part, which is
Right.
So talk about the Lorentzian part. In the Lorentzian part, if you measure a distance in one frame, if you measure a distance in a different frame, you measure something different. In space-time, you're measuring the gravitational field here, the gravitational field here. And in loop quantum mechanics, what happens is these operators do not commute. So either you measure the plane or the other one, you cannot measure the two together. And the reason you can have both with discrete spectrum is for the same reason you can have, LZ operator in angular momentum discrete, and also LZ in another direction discrete. They don't commute, so you can have both. I don't know if this doesn't talk to you because it's a different language, it's a different story, but I don't know if there's some.
I wrote a paper with Martin Boyerman, but you didn't. With Martin Boyerman, and we looked at the beginning of your questions, but we didn't get as far as really looking at the relativistic situation. It was basically the non-relativistic situation.
Am I allowed a second question? This is a very simple and trivial one. Maybe something slightly confused me along the presentation, which is that when I study quantum field theory, I learned that there are no, even in a free field, operators at a point. Here you seem to circumvent that. What is it that makes it work in a? Because you have a free quantum field, and then you happily start talking about operators at a point, and it seemed to be correct. It sounds correct, but you cannot do in normal quantum theory. You only have smeared things.
Yes, that's a good point, but. What's at the heart of why this becomes possible is that the position operator in ordinary quantum mechanics has a continuous spectrum, and the eigenvectors in quotation mark are not normalizable. But when you impose the color, then you get representations of lattices, which means you get families of self-adjoint extensions of a position operator, each one of which has a discrete spectrum, and that ensures that the eigenfunctions are normalizable. And that translates into the fact that in quantum field theory, we can actually work with operators at points.
I see. This is very nice.
More questions?
Just a remark. So when you talk about curved space time, I think you must be talking about some special examples, because generically you wouldn't have Fourier transform. So you're probably thinking about some like static or quasi-static or whatever, right? I mean, you just cannot do it.
But you can still talk about the spectrum, I mean, the eigenfunctions of a covariant Dalin-Boerschen operator. Like the Laplace-Beltrami operator, we can just restrict its eigenfunctions and project on its own.
Yeah.
Exactly right. And the generic curved space time wouldn't know what eigenfunctions to a momentum operator would be. However, the Dalin-Boerschen operator, which is the sum of the Knoll square minus B vector space in the constant space, the Dalin-Boerschen operator generalizes, and it's a scalar operator, and its spectrum consists of scalar invariant of the manifold.
You cut off that spectrum.
And that tells you what the remainder of the function space, the subspace of the Hilbert space, spanned by the eigenfunction of the Dalin-Boerschen, up to a maximal eigenvalue. That's a covariant.
That's still some subtleties, because from what I know in spectral theory literature, blah blah, it seems like you probably can do it only if you have asymptotically flat or asymptotically nice space times. Otherwise, I'm not sure about, stupid details how is Dalin-Boerschen behaving as an operator in these function spaces. So it may or may not be self-adjoint, and the spectrum might look something weird. So I'm just wondering how you go with
that. I don't think there will be trouble with the asymptotics. There could be singularities.
Yes.
We have singularities, and it could be you know, the so-called quantum singularities are the ones where exactly you have to specify boundary conditions to make the double versions of the job.
Okay.
So there can be situations where you have to specify boundary conditions.
So that happens in the. Yeah, that happens in the FRW case, right? You have to you have a non-self-adjoint. Or the power loss.
Okay. So we wrote a paper where he went through all of the details of
that.
He did here in 2017.
Uh-huh. I will ask.
So just wonder broadly, what do you say about quantum gravity? It seems you started by motivating this cutoff through quantum gravity and modified GUPs.
Mm-hmm.
Then one could think of just one could start with the cutoff. I said nothing about motivation. I just impose this mathematical cutoff in the momentum space
mm-hmm.
and do everything. So in the end, there's a question: what does this procedure say about quantum gravity? Say, if I want to attack the question of quantum gravity, do I treat gravity as a field and then impose this cutoff, or is gravity already contained in your procedure?
No, we're just looking at modifications of quantum field theory as you approach the Planck scale. So it's, you know, I mean, it's motivated from the idea that there's quantum gravity effects happening at the Planck scale, but we're not quantizing gravity, right? We're just, you know, starting to look at how the effects of a minimum length scenario would appear in a low energy regime. We're still just working with quantum field theory.
Of course, he hasn't talked about this in this presentation, but in principle, we are asking the question also, how do we put back the limitation of gravity itself? And then how does it all of that mesh together? But that leads to spectral geometry, and that's a whole different topic.
So now that you mentioned this generalized uncertainty principle, do you have, like, constraints from experiments already do you have an idea how phenomenology might come into the game?
No, so not for the Lorentzian version. I mean, there's been lots of papers on the ordinary generalized uncertainty principle, like this first one. I mean, it's a whole slew of papers looking at possible phenomenology. But I guess what I'm interested in more is the Lorentzian version, what kind of phenomena you'd see in this. And then Achim wrote this paper about the fluctuation spectrum in inflationary cosmology, how this would be modified.
You see, the hope there is this. During inflation, the Hubble horizon was only about 5 orders of magnitude larger than the Planck thing. And that means that there could be a Planck scale effect visible in the CMB at the order of 10 to the minus 5. So whenever somebody has a theory of quantum gravity, be it strings or loops or whatever, the challenge is out there. Calculate what it does to inflation, because the effect should be about 10 to the minus 5, or 10 to the minus 5 on the CMB spectrum. And we did that for that cutoff. So we put the covariant cutoff into cosmological inflation. We calculated exactly what the impact on the predicted spectrum for the CMB is. It's a particular signature, there's only one free parameter in the prediction, which is the actual value of the cutoff, Mach length. And it's a very firm prediction. If it were measured, it could rule out the theory. But I think it's more generally, independently of what Jason and I are working on, any theory of quantum gravity, I think, should be tested for how would it modify inflation? Because it's the closest we can get to experimental observability. It's a 10 to the minus 5 effect. And with experiments, we are at about 10 to the minus 3. We're just 2 orders of magnitude away from probing time scale physics in the CMB. Just use your quantum gravity theory to predict the CMB, and it might be tested.
But just on that note, blue quantum cosmology is, for example, trying to look into this.
Oh,
so, what are like the changes in the power spectrum of the CMB?
There's a big literature. I mean, I think you know it as well. So there's hundreds of papers.
I'm predicting the CMB.
Well, yeah, sure.
The 10 to the minus
Ivan,
5, right?
Ivan,
or just like modifications to the skimming spectrum compared to the London CDM model, for example.
Yeah.
So, which is, I think, particular for the very low momentum. Okay. So, exactly that part, which is extremely difficult to measure. But there are some predictions, though. There are at least some models that look into this. Yeah. Are there more questions for Jason?
So, one quick. So you have this theta, which is the modified certainty principle.
Yep.
So for you, it's just a free parameter that you have some ansatz maybe that
mm-hmm.
looks nice, but it's up to the theory of quantum gravity to tell you what to put there.
Yeah, exactly. So I just kept it sort of generic, and then see what you get. And generically, you get this covariant.
Generically, if you keep the coordinates commutative, you have that nice utility property.
Why do you restrict the change of your uncertainty principle to only include your momentum and not your moment?
So that was just analogous to the ordinary GUP, where if you let that depend on your coordinates, you generically you get IR cutoff. And so we're interested in the UV behavior, so that's why we just made it function momentum. I mean, you could in principle put an X in there, it's just the analysis becomes more complicated and so on. I mean, you can't play the same tricks I did and so on, but yeah, really it's just for simplicity, I guess.
There are things on that. For example, you could have a non-commutativity of the P expressing curvature. Because P generates translations, and then the non-commutativity of parallel transport can be interpreted as non-commutativity of momentum operators. And then you get automatically also that this impacts the XP.
There's a full school of people just changing the XX, the people in Rome, the people in Poland, the ones that you're putting P there, is the one you studied, is it the same that come from string theory, Ciafaloni, Veneziano, Amati, is that?
Yeah. Any more questions? I didn't see any, so thank you, Jason, again.
Thank you.